right. Today, we're going to be starting in Genesis chapter 16. Last week, we covered chapter 15. And what we saw in chapter 15 was a great time of worship in the first large portion of the chapter. Moses and the Israelites have just completed the crossing of the sea. God's great miracles were done. They witnessed the destruction of Pharaoh and all of his army. And Moses bursts out in song along with the people as they say that, "Lord is my strength and he's my song." And they praise him, they extol him, they hold him up, they cite his power as seen in these events. They're specific about what God has done. They restate the details of the parting of the waters and the crossing on dry ground and the resulting destruction of the Egyptian army. And some things that come out of that is a declaration of God's loving kindness toward them. They see it. They call it redemption. He says that they say he is the redemption of the sons of Israel. They realize what a big transition has been made in who they are, what's going on, because of what God has done that has just been seen with great vividness in this Red Sea crossing and the miracles of God that surrounded it. They recognize his actions to bring the people to Canaan. They expect that he is going to do that. They affirm their faith in God giving them the promise from the time of Abraham. And they mention that great fear has been created in the inhabitants of Canaan, and that God's reign there will be forever. Miriam, Moses' sister, leads the women in song with tambourines, and they just have this great time where they are gleefully worshiping God and recognizing him as the one that is redeeming them out of their slavery and will establish them as a nation in Israel. And then we get to the last part of the chapter. Moses led the people into the desert of Shur. They went 3 days and no water. They come to a place that they will come to call Marah, because the waters there are bitter, and that's what Marah means, is bitter. And the people grumble to Moses. "Well, what are we supposed to drink?" I mean, it's just such a short time after such a great miracle, and they think that it is the circumstances that they see in life that determine what's going to happen and what's going on. Now, we need to remember that during this three-day journey, the pillars of cloud and fire are still continuing to guide them. And Moses, in their grumbling, cries out to God, and God shows him a tree that he threw into the water. And by throwing the tree in the water, I say by, upon is a better word than by. Upon throwing the tree in the waters become sweet. And God says, with this time of testing, I've been testing the people, will come statutes and regulations. And he says, here's what's required, that the people will give an earnest heed to the voice of the Lord. Listen to him and do right in his sight. And then God says, if you do what is required, if you follow this statute, then this is what he is going to do. And what he says he's going to do is to withhold the diseases from you that I placed on Egypt. A very clear implication there. If you don't, I will treat you like the Egyptians. And so they've got a very clear dichotomy to think about there, about which path do they want to take. And God says, I, the Lord, am your healer. That's a part of what he says here. I'm the healer, and I'm going to take you through this, and you're going to need to pay attention to what I command and do it, and then I will see that you're not plagued like the Egyptians were, and as a matter of fact, you'll be blessed with my promises. So at the end of the chapter, they came to Elim, and there were 12 springs of water, 70 date palms, and they camped there. And you can imagine how that must have felt compared to 3 days without water. And then they do get some sweet water, But now they're here really in kind of an oasis, wonderful place, and God's showing them, this is what I can do for you. This is a part of my taking care of you. And so they get to see a picture of where God would take them if they but follow him. Questions or comments, thinking about last week? One of the things that I think is so true from last week, it reveals to us with much more accurate detail than we would like about the nature of what it means to be one of mankind. We can experience the most wonderful blessings of God on day one, and on day two be in despair about what are we going to do because we don't have what we need. And we think that we are being treated badly. And in reality, that's just so much who we can easily be and often are. We'll continue with our lesson today. I've got so many thoughts running through my head from some things this last week about how easy it is for me to go from euphoria to despair over the simplest of things when I think things ought to be a certain way. But let's begin with Exodus chapter 16, and we will look at the first 7 verses to begin with. So it says in 16:1, then they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to them, would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven, and you and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them, whether or not they will walk in my instruction. On the 6th day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. So Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, at evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your grumblings against the Lord. And what are we that you grumble against us? And we'll get some more instructions about that in a bit. But they left Elim. They're out in the wilderness of Sin, which one of the challenges with the camping spots and these various things that are named is we can't really get into the land that most likely this all occurred and excavate and look through things archaeologically. So there's a lot of opinions, but not anything super definitive about where some of these are. But no, if we think of Mount Sinai as being Jabal al-Laws, which I think is fairly certain when we look at the crossing that most likely occurred back in the Sea of Aqaba, then the wilderness of Sin is probably some distance south of that mountain and the pathway to that mountain. And it says that they're on the 15th day of the second month from when they left Egypt. So when did they leave Egypt? Do you remember? Go to Exodus 12:6. This is pulled out of the passage of the Passover. And we'll read Exodus 12:6. This is when it's really happening. And we get some very specific instructions. And it says, you shall keep it. This is the goat that they were, goat, sorry. This is the lamb that they were to sacrifice in the Passover. So they were to select it. And then it says, you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it and eat it at twilight. And the next morning then they're going to leave, right? So they Actually, we're leaving on the 15th day of the first month. And now we're at the second month. So they've been out there 30 days since they left, since the night of the Passover when they left Egypt. And so in those, I say 30 days, how long was the month? A lot of the Jewish calendar was done by moons. Maybe it was 28 days. But not all of it was done exactly lined up with moons. They basically used a 360-day year most years. When we get done, it's probably about 30 days that they have been out there. And in verse 2, the first part of that is depressing to me. And it says, the whole congregation. That's the depressing part. Along with grumbled against Moses and Aaron. You know, you would think out of that many people, there might be a few that still remember the Red Sea crossing and what came out of that, and the words that came to them when they received the fresh water, the sweet water, at Marah. God says, I'm going to test you. Are you going to do what I say? I'll take care of you. And then he takes them to the place of wells and palms, 12 wells and 70 palm trees, in this wonderful place out in the desert. And then just a little later, here they are, all of them grumbling again. One of my favorite facetious sayings that I use too often, when I make a mistake, I say, well, if you find something you can do consistently, you ought to do it often. In other words, I make lots of mistakes. But the thing they know how to do well is grumble. And boy, do they do it often. They can't ever be patient to see how God is going to work out what's going to happen. They assume the worst in every situation. They're out there going, what are we supposed to do? And they grumbled to Moses and Aaron, and in verse 3 they said, this is what we wish had happened. And they go a little further than they have in the past, although it's been implied in the past. We wish we had died in Egypt, there by pots full of meat, and we had all the bread we wanted. We wish the Lord had killed us there. You realize what they're saying? The Egyptians were better off than we are. In all their plagues, in all their death, we wish God had killed us. And that's quite a thing to say. Instead of coming out here, because out here they say in verse 3, you are going to kill all of us by hunger. So the only two choices in life that they have picked out is, we could have died in Egypt at God's hand, or we'll die out here following Moses and Aaron around and starve to death. Now, that's pretty extreme. There's something that we ought not forget. Go back to chapter 13 for a minute. We're going to look at verses 21 and 22. And I've already said this essentially once today, but we just need to keep this in mind. As they are leaving, it says, the Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on a way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light that they might travel by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. So this is kind of an audacious thing, because they're not just grumbling to Moses and Aaron. You know when we sin, can we keep our sin secret? Maybe from some people. But when we sin right in front of the face of the most holy God. And there's some value in awareness of that as we live our lives. We don't get to sit behind some shield and not be known by God as we sin. And God's very clear about, you're not going to mock me by thinking you're going to hide it. What's done in secret will be shown, will be revealed in the public. And so here they are grumbling to Moses and Aaron in the presence of the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. That's pretty audacious behavior if they really understood what's going on. God's going to see and hear that grumbling. So, when was their last grumbling?
Water.
Back in Mara, right? They'd gone 3 days and they were grumbling. How did God respond to their grumbling? Gave them water. Put the tree in here, Moses, but he did something else too. We just mentioned it a little bit ago. What did he add to the game?
He required their obedience.
Statutes. And he says out loud, I'm going to test the people. So how do you think they're doing so far? Well, you know what's even sadder, maybe? How do you think we're doing so far? You know, it's easy to point at these guys and go, how could they be so dense? Well, I don't know. We're probably totally unaware of how dense we are so often. But so God is bringing the test, and here they are being tested, and they are grumbling. And in verse 4, God intervenes. He says to Moses, I'm going to rain bread from heaven, so have the people gather a day's portion each day. So what did God state was his purpose in this verse? Do you see that? Verse 4. Take a peek there if you need to. Exodus 16, verse 4.
Well, he was testing to make sure that that's all that they did. He wanted to take only that much and not anymore.
That's true. And that's a part of what I'm aiming at. What's that?
He's testing.
Yeah. He said, I'm going to test them whether or not they will walk in my instruction. So here's Moses. Here's some simple instruction. They're going to gather this bread, and he even gives them more instruction in verse 5. On the sixth day, they need to gather a double portion. So in verse 6, Moses and Aaron talk to the people. And they are wise enough, I think, through God's revelation to them, that they add the purpose statement. So you will know the Lord brought you out of Egypt. Pay attention, folks, he says. You need to remember who brought you out of Egypt. And behind that is how he did it, the power he has shown, and what his attributes are. And in the morning, verse 7, it says, you will see, what will they see? The glory of the Lord. For he hears your grumbling against the Lord, and what are we that you grumble against us? And that's a good question. What is the role of Moses and Aaron as they're making this trek, as they get the freedom from Egypt, and then make this trek toward the first goal, the first big goal is Mount Sinai? What's their role?
They're emissaries from God.
Yeah, they're servants. They come and grumble to Moses and Aaron. And Moses and Aaron are rightly looking at them, going, why are you grumbling to me? Don't you realize we're just following God's instruction? God is directing this path. Remember? See that pillar? See that pillar? This is not some Moses Aaron production. This is the great God himself leading you out here, and every step of the way has been taking care of you. And so why are you grumbling to us? Questions, comment over those first 7 verses.
A trial, God's deemed that worthy for you. So whether you're complaining against the person, you think you're complaining against your boss, against your husband, against your wife, against whomever, you're actually complaining against God and what he's deemed for you to go through as he tests you to see, and he's not going to give us something we can't handle, so he thinks we're ready for that, and it just makes me think how often I fail him in that area.
Yeah, and one of the pieces of not giving us something we can't handle and I don't mean to pick on how you said that, but even in the words of that, even the way we think of that, we expect to be, particularly in the time and place that we live, self-sufficient. Part of my current situation in life is trying to address all of the things that need to be taken care of as a result of my father's passing here a couple of months ago. And it's rather overwhelming, not to bring too much into it, but he didn't know how to throw away or sell anything. And he lived to be 85 and had lots of interests. And one sad thing about that is I see myself in him so much. But in that regard, that's a good thing for the most part, but in that regard, not so much. And so my mother and I are figuring out how to do everything. And I'm just, in reading this week, I'm like, yeah, I think I'm smart enough to figure all this out. And isn't that how we live? I mean, when you look at the history, the heritage, some of this, if we had a younger crowd, and we have some younger people in here, but you don't hear this phrase so much anymore, but it was said with somewhat of an admiration. He pulled himself up by his own bootstraps. No, it doesn't work that way, does it? We tend to think that we can chart a course, that we can make things happen, that how things turn out in our lives is because of how either intelligent we were or how hard we worked, what kind of wisdom and insight we had, and so on. And that's an affront to God. It really is an affront to God when we think life turns out because of what we bring to the game. The scriptures ask the question, what do you have that you did not get from above? And that's a very good question to stop and ask, and then it's a good strategy to live out your life recognizing that, yeah, God may have given you the ability to figure some things out. And God doesn't expect us to go through life without using what he's given us. So we ought to use our intelligence. We ought to use our wisdom. We ought to use the vigor of our youth when we have it. Boy, what I would give to have that back right now. I need it this next year or two. But, you know, we ought to use those things, but we ought to use them in subjection to who God is and what would really make his kingdom prosper and what would really bring him the honor he deserves. So enough side preaching on that. But here we are, and Moses makes it clear, you're going to see the glory of the Lord. It's about the glory of the Lord that he's going to provide this for you so you can get it. And so there are, in verse 9, they call the people forward. I already mentioned what they said. Well, no, I didn't. They call the people before the Lord, and they tell him, God's heard your grumbling. And as Aaron spoke to the people, they looked toward the wilderness, and something happened. The glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. That phrase about the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud starts with the word behold. It's an exclamation point kind of a word. And so the glory of the Lord shows up to them in the cloud. The cloud was already there. How did the glory of the Lord show up in the cloud? I can't begin to tell you. I don't have any idea. It wasn't described here. But as they looked toward the wilderness, both Aaron and Moses and the people understood they were seeing the glory of the Lord in a way beyond what they normally saw when they looked at that cloud. And I think God is putting his exclamation point on what they're saying. This is about God. It's not about you. You need bread, but the real reason for bringing the bread is so you can get it. Who's here? Who's in charge? Who's doing it? And so God is showing his glory there. In verse 11, then the Lord speaks to Moses. In verse 12, we hear that he said, I have heard the grumbling of the sons of Israel. This is what you tell them. At twilight, you will eat meat. And in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord Jehovah your God. And the words there when he says, I am the Lord Jehovah your God. The Lord Jehovah is the Lord is Jehovah, and God is Elohim, God Almighty. I am the I am, and I am Almighty. And so God is saying, you need to know this. And I just realized I didn't read this passage for you. So let me back up and read that, and we'll pick it back up with verse 13. We're going to read 8 through 21 right now. And Moses said, this will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and bread to the full in the morning. For the Lord hears your grumblings, which you grumble against him. And what are we? Your grumblings are not against us, but against the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, say to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumblings. It came about as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the sons of Israel that they looked toward the wilderness. And behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I have heard the grumbling of the sons of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. So it came about at evening that the quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew evaporated, behold, on the surface of the wilderness, there was a fine, flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. When the sons of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it every man as much as he should eat, and you shall take an omer apiece according to the number of persons each of you has in his tent. The sons of Israel did so, and some gathered much and some little. When they measured it with an omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered as much as he should eat. Then Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it until morning. But they did not listen to Moses, and some left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them. They gathered it morning by morning, every man, as much as he should eat. But when the sun grew hot, it would melt. Okay, so we talked through part of that. In verse 13, we see that it came about in the evening that the camp was covered with quail. And in the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew evaporated on the surface of the wilderness, there was a fine flake-like coating on the ground as fine as frost. So you've seen frost on the ground. And so they saw that. What did they say when they saw it? There in verse 15.
What is it?
In the Hebrew, there's a little bit that gets lost between the enunciation of these words between Hebrew and Greek. But basically in Hebrew, it was man hu. And that means, what is it? And that's where the word manna comes from. And we'll see that as we go down through it. Literally, they called it, all of its life, the what is it? That's what the name manna meant. They didn't know what it was. By the way, I'm sure you've heard the story, but when they arrived in Australia, the British saw the kangaroo for the first time. And they asked the natives, what is that? And they said, kangaroo, which basically said, we don't understand. So the kangaroo in the native language, they didn't understand the question, in other words. The English kangaroo was a transliteration of them trying to say, we don't get your question. But anyway, similar to that, they didn't know what it was. And Moses tells them, it's the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. And he continued and said, the Lord has commanded. Why is it important that that Moses here say, this is a commandment of the Lord?
Realize
God said it. What did you say?
It was
coming from the Lord. And they had been told they're going to be tested. Will you do what I say?
Yeah.
So Moses said, this is from the Lord, gather it each man, just enough for everyone in the tent, should be an omer apiece, which is about 2 quart. Which gives you a little bit of an idea of the volume of this thing. So, 1 million plus people each needing 2 quart?
That's a lot.
There's a lot of this stuff out there. And they gathered, some much and some little. And then when they get back and they start measuring it, well, what do you know? Everybody had the right amount gathered. And so there's a miracle right there, that as they gathered it, trying to guess at the right amount, when they get back, it is the right amount, regardless if they gathered little or too much. And then in verse 19, Moses says, by the way, don't have leftovers. That's not exactly how he said it, but leftovers were not a good idea. Don't save any past the morning. And of course, in verse 20, we see that these people, some of them at least, are still very consistent. They don't listen, they don't obey, they don't follow instructions, and they left some for the morning. And what happened to that?
Worms.
It bred worms. It went wormy and became foul. Once again, I would give God the credit for that. How's Moses respond?
Angry.
Is he right to be angry?
Yeah.
Why?
God shouldn't have sent worms. He should have struck everyone dead.
You know, in a very real sense, that would have been true justice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
God's not meting out justice here to an extent he is, but for the most part, God is meting out training. He's trying to bring them to the place he wants them to be. But Moses was angry. Moses knew they were being tested, and you guys are out here making us look bad. Stop it. Follow instructions. And so they, in verse 21, continued to gather it morning by morning, every man getting the right amount. But of course, when the day got hot, it would melt. Was it truly a frost? We'll get at that in a little bit. We'll get at that in a little bit. So, any questions or comments down through verse 21 there? So let's read the rest of this chapter. And this tells what happened on the sixth day when they were to double gather. Now on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for each one. An omer is about 2 quarts, so now they're gathering 4. When all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, then he said to them, this is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow's a Sabbath observance, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over put aside to be kept until morning. So they put it aside until morning as Moses had ordered, and it did not become foul, nor was there any worm in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days shall you gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none. It came about on the seventh day that some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. Then the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you the bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Remain every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested the seventh day. The house of Israel named it manna, and it was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like wafers with honey. Then Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omerful of it be kept throughout your generations, that they may see the bread that I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omerful of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. The sons of Israel ate manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. Now an omer is a tenth of an ephah. Okay, so Moses takes the opportunity to teach about the Sabbath. The 6 days to be different. They're to gather twice as much bread, 2 omers for each one. And when they did that, the leaders came and told Moses that they had done it. And when they came, Moses explains it to them in verse 23. The Lord's meaning is that tomorrow, the seventh day in this case, the Sabbath is an observance. It's a holy Sabbath to the Lord. It is to be a time of worship, if you will. And he said, bake and boil it as you decide, and the leftovers then are to be kept for the next morning. So they do their preparation on the sixth day, and on the seventh day, it should all be prepared, which is fascinating if you look at that. So did they just eat it straight? Well, we don't know. But sometimes they would prepare it. They would bake it, and they would boil it. So let's go back to the heat of the sun part. What happened when the heat of the sun came out in the middle of the day? How do you bake and boil something that you can melt? Uh-huh. This is not just a physics lesson. This is an anti-physics lesson. This is God owns physics, okay? And so God has set this up. So apparently they were baking some of it and boiling some of it. I have no idea beyond what it says here, but that's what they were doing. And maybe all of it was prepared. I don't know. But prepare on the sixth day. Gather double. Prepare it, all of it, for your consumption on the seventh day. And then when they put it aside as Moses directed, what happened? Did it spoil?
No.
Well, now, if this thing would breed worms overnight and get rancid or whatever it did to be spoiled, but it doesn't happen on the seventh day, once again we see everything about this way that God is providing them with their food is supernatural. This is not just God dealing with the natural in some way. And then on the seventh day, Moses said in verse 25, eat it today. This is a Sabbath to the Lord. And if you go out to gather, you won't find a fresh crop today. There is not more to gather. You gather for 6 days, and then on the Sabbath, there will be none. Did all the people get that and do it? A few people went out to gather on the seventh day. Did they learn something? Yep, God is consistent, and there was nothing to gather. And God talks to Moses about that, doesn't he? In verse 28, God said to Moses, how long will you rebel and not keep my commandments? Is he talking to Moses about his own sin?
Yes, no.
In specific this time, he's really not. Because when people tried to keep it to the next day, Moses is angry. Why was he angry? Because he was God's conduit. You want to make God mad, don't do it on my watch, because I know who God's going to bring the issue to, and I don't want to deal with it. You know, do what he says. And sure enough, here's God coming to Moses and saying, how long are you guys going to rebel? And so Moses is back to the people. Verse 29, although I think this is God speaking to Moses yet, sorry. I went round and round on this one. See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Remain every man in his place. Let no man go out of this place on the seventh day. So the people rested. Here's God's message. This is a Sabbath to the Lord. He's given you the bread. He's asking you for the Sabbath. Do the Sabbath. And so everyone is to stay inside. This is a time to be within the camp, within your tent or whatever you're resting, dwelling in. And verse 30, so the people did rest on that seventh day. Either through God talking to Moses or Moses talking to the people, it became known what was expected, and they began to do it. That word Sabbath, this is the first time it shows up in the scriptures. And it really isn't defined by the scriptures here. When you go back and look at the word's background, the way that I read it, it said it's an intensive intermission. Now, I don't know how you make, in normal parlance, the normal part of life, go to a movie and you have an intermission in the old days while they changed reels or something, right? Well, now intermissions are kind of gone, although you might go to a concert where they have an intermission or something. But an intermission is a break. It's a stop. It's not, things aren't going on anymore. How did you make that more intensive? I don't know. But I think it becomes clear to us real quick what they mean by an intensive intermission. This isn't just take a break. This is a directive from God that you're going to take this day and do no labor. You're not, the only labor they had at that point was gathering the food and traveling. They're not traveling and they're not gathering the food. And so in this chapter we see it brought into being. You might say an intensive pause or an intensive rest, but this is a stop. But this isn't just so people can catch their breath. This is a way that God asks to be worshiped. And we very quickly will relate it, because it's going to be related later in the Bible. What will we relate this seventh day rest to?
Remember the Sabbath, keep it holy.
Well, it's going to be a command. But what's the link of the Sabbath? Back to
creation.
6 days God created and the seventh he rested. And that's going to be part of the explanation when it becomes a command. And so that's what they're going to be doing. And then questions or comments so far down through verse 30. Okay? In verse 31, it says, the house of Israel named it manna. And we talked about where that came from. And we get our first, well, not our first, but we get some additional description. They said it was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like wafers with honey. So I looked up coriander seed. I know it's a spice, but I've never dealt with it. And physically, when I looked at the photos of coriander seed, it reminded me of harvested milo or sorghum from the sorghum plants. It's about the size it was, about the color it was. And it looked like in the pictures that coriander is probably a fairly hard seed. Reminded me a little bit of a peppercorn, except these are white. That's the only difference that we are given. But its taste was like wafers with honey. I don't think I've ever had a seed of any kind that tasted like wafers with honey. So it had an unusual flavor in that regard. The people that try to see the scriptures without miracles, do you know what kinds of things they say this manna was? It might have been in some of the videos you watched. No, I don't think so. So we didn't watch the videos that might have had this in it. Well, there's a couple of things that are out there. One is people have said it's lichen, the mossy stuff, and it would grow up overnight and, you know, when the water was just right and everything. Yeah, right, and we're going to get enough of that to feed over 1 million people. The other one...
It's
going to taste like honey. Well, the other one, there is a bug that secretes something that is white and is sweet tasting if you go to eat it. And at times of the year, overnight, it will put a layer of this out there in desert areas like that. But once again, you're not going to get enough. And so let me ask you, just from a logical standpoint, how do we know absolutely, without looking and thinking any more about it, that this is neither lichen nor bug secretions?
It's provided by God.
Okay, provided by God.
They didn't know what it was.
There's another couple of them that are pretty good.
Well, they probably didn't melt when the sun came out.
The things that happened is the way I'll put it. Melt when the sun comes out. I don't know if they did or didn't, but one thing's about it for sure. If you gathered it on the sixth day, you could keep some overnight. But If you gathered it extra any other day and tried to keep it overnight, you're going to get worms and spoilage. Now, what lichen or what bug secretion can tell the difference between days 1 through 5 and 6 and 7? I mean, there's just too many other miracles going on to even begin to think that there's a natural product out there that God would use. And even if he did use a natural product, there's still a miracle going on that he makes it so it reacts differently.
But honey doesn't spoil. It can be reconstituted from Egyptian.
If it really was honey, but this is, it didn't say it was honey. It said it tastes like honey. But go over to Psalm 78, 23 through 25. This psalm I've been trying to save for the right moment. This isn't the right moment. So we're just going to steal a little bit out of it, not do the whole psalm. But let's look at Psalm 78, 23 through 25, and it talks about the Israelite trip to the promised land here in Psalm 78. Pretty critical of the Israelites most of the time. But there are some things in here that are very valuable to us, and I think this explains manna better than any other way we could get it explained. Verse 23 in Psalm 78. Yet he commanded the clouds above and opened the doors of heaven. He rained down manna upon them to eat, and he gave them food from heaven. Man did eat the bread of angels. He sent them food in abundance. He caused the east wind to blow in the heavens, and by his power he directed the south winds. When he rained meat upon them like the dust, even the winged fowl like the sand of the sea, then he let them fall in the midst of their camp, round about their dwellings. So this deals with both the manna and the meat from the quail. But notice that man did eat the bread of angels. There's quite a crossover going on there, that God has given them heavenly food. Yes, sir.
There's an ancient Assyrian tradition of making halva. Halva is made out of coriander seed.
Mm-hmm.
Before Easter, it's put in Christians' pockets so they can go to war with a food that will not spoil. And it's delicious. We mm-hmm. eat it all the time.
Yeah.
And it won't spoil.
Of course, in this case, this wasn't coriander seed, but reminded them of coriander seed.
That's a food that won't spoil.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. So then if we continue in verse 32, Moses, in verse 32, let me get my orientation back. Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omerful of it be kept throughout the generations. And he has a purpose. And what's his purpose? So they can see the bread I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. Now, when is that bread going to spoil? It's not. It's going to stay good. So God commands Moses to gather this so it can be kept as a reminder of what has been done. It's a tribute to God. So Moses says to Aaron in verse 33, take a jar, an omer full of manna, place it before the Lord to be kept through all generations. Verse 34, as the Lord commanded to Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony. You could also translate that before the witness. Now later, we know where that's going to be. Where's it going to be placed later?
Ark.
In the ark. And when the ark and the tabernacle together, it's going to be in the Holy of Holies, in there. So they've got the manna saved. Where is he placing it now? I don't know. It's before the testimony as a witness. I'm sure they carried it prominently. I'm sure it was prominently displayed. Probably wanted it to be a place that the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire could also be viewed and could view it. But I just really don't have anything I can tell you definitively about what that, before the testimony, what that really means. Verse 35 is interesting because now we're looking ahead into the years that are going to go on. The sons of Israel ate the manna 40 years. until they came to an inhabited land. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. So God is going to continue to provide this manna day after day after day, year after year, following the same progression. 6 days, on the sixth day, gather double portion. And so God continued to provide that. And so every day they had a miracle of God shown to them in providing their food. And you might think that that would make it clear to them who's leading them and how much confidence they could have in him, but it doesn't quite work out that way. And then finally he tells us that an omer is a tenth of an ephah, and that's where we get that an omer is just a little over 2 quarts. Questions, comments so far? Yes, sir.
One quick observation. To reconcile the Exodus, by far the greatest exodus of people in the history of mankind was the United States. And we, our very, very first law as a nation was to proclaim the treaties in the Ohio area of the British with the Indians null and void because of our manifest destiny to take the land. And to reconcile in regard to the Exodus, the people who manifest destiny,
yeah,
the right of God.
Well, that's one that we imagined that right. That right didn't really exist. Go back to Psalm 78 for a minute. I want to show you what God was having put down by the writer of the psalmist in that Psalm 78, right before they mention the manna. Because, and the manna is not mentioned in Psalm 78 in chronological sequence. Because there's some things that it mentions that happened later that are mentioned earlier in Psalm 78. But let's look at verses 14 through 22. This is somewhat general about how God is leading them. He led them with the cloud by day. I'm starting with verse 14 of Psalm 78. He led them with the cloud by day and all the night with a light of fire. He split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them abundant drink like the ocean depths. He brought forth streams also from the rock, and he caused waters to run like rivers. Yet they still continued to sin against him, to rebel against the Most High in the desert, and in their heart they put God to the test. Who's supposed to be tested? Not God. By asking food according to their need? No, their desire. Then they spoke against God, and they said, "Can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, he struck the rock so that the waters gushed out and streams were overflowing. Can he give bread also? Will he provide meat for his people?" Therefore the Lord heard and was full of wrath. And a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also mounted against Israel, because they did not believe in God and did not trust in his salvation. That defines or clarifies what's going on in God's thoughts as these people continue to accept his provision for them, accept his miracles on their behalf, accept his leadership when it's going well, and then rebel every time they don't feel comfortable. And it's a pretty strong indictment. His wrath was kindled against the sons of Jacob. Go over to Hebrews chapter 3. I'm going to start with verse 13, and I'll start with verse 12. I'll start with 12 and read through chapter 4, verse 1. This is the writer of Hebrews talking about the Exodus people. "Take care, brethren, that there not be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God. But encourage one another day after day, as long as it's still called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance, firm until the end, while it is said, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me. For who provoked him when they had heard? Indeed, did not all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. Therefore, let us fear, if while the promise still remains of entering his rest, any one of you may seem to have come short of it. And it continues. There's not a great stopping point there. My point is this. The writer of Hebrews looks back to the time of the Israelites and the wrath that God kindled against them because of their unbelief. And it reaches a pinnacle much later than we'll see in the book of Exodus, when they stand at Canaan's gate and Moses sends out spies and they come back and say, there's not a chance. 10 of the 12 spies say, there's not a chance. They will overrun us. These people have been following God for a fair amount of time now, seeing his great power and his great miracles. And when they come to the land of Canaan, a land he has promised, they say, can't be done. And they lack faith. And they are sinful people. They're disobedient. They're rebellious. And the writer of Hebrews is looking at these people in shortly after the time of Christ that were Jews once and now are missing the prestige that came from being a Jew inside a Jewish culture, and are considering maybe we would have been better off back following our Hebrew roots. And the writer of Hebrews says, what are you doing? What are you thinking? Christ is far greater, and he's going to spend the whole book of Hebrews showing how the person of Christ is greater than anything that was ever seen in the wilderness. But here in chapter 3, he's beginning his case by saying, don't you realize that the people who followed their heritage didn't get to enter Canaan because of sin and lack of faith and unbelief? Don't be like them. And it's a lesson for us. We live in a world where, I mean, in all honesty, I can eat lunch anywhere I want to eat lunch today. If I need to buy another car, I'll find a way, have a way to buy another. Anything I think I truly need or want within some limitations, everybody's got some limitations, but I can have it. And I don't have to worry about it. It's already there. It's already in process. Wisdom, I think, would be to prepare for retirement years, and we've done it. So, oh boy, I don't have anything to worry about. What will I do when the day comes that that's disrupted? I don't think it's very hard to stretch your imagination to say that's much more in the realm of likeliness than it was a few years ago, certainly a few decades ago. We see the rise of the rebellion of mankind continuing day by day. And the fruit of that rebellion will be they will not want to be reminded of anything that is Christian, and they will want all of the power, they'll want all of the wealth, and they're going to want control of everything. And they will be essentially usurping God in that sense to the best of their abilities. I really don't want to talk about politics. What I want to talk about is we need not fear that. We may go through terrible times in the definitions of mankind living in this world, but we serve a living God that has no boundaries. And the day will come when the scriptures tell us the righteous will live by faith. That's what the Hebrews didn't do. That's what angered God. The day will come for each of us, I believe, in some way or another, even in the midst of prosperity, where we're going to have to decide if we want to live by faith or by our own means. And we've probably reached that decision point time and time again already in our lives, and we probably can even point to those if we stop and are honest with ourselves about significant points in time when we had to decide, am I going to trust God or am I going to do it through the world? And so I just want to give you the same warning that the writer of Hebrews gave. Don't be a sinner. Sin is deceitful. Sin will keep you from faith. Deal with sin. Put sin aside. Put it to death. Live a life that is obedient to Jesus Christ. Your personal holiness matters. It matters in your relationship with God, and it matters for eternity. We don't earn our way into heaven. It isn't through our personal holiness that makes us acceptable to God. Our personal holiness comes out of our response to the salvation that Jesus Christ brings to us. But by all means, respond. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. We must give God his place in our lives. That's what it means to be in the family of God. Questions, comments? All right, well, we'll see you next week.